Hello, this is Guardian Daily. It's Monday, October the 5th. I'm Michael White in Manchester, the third of the major party conferences. The Conservatives are meeting here for what they hope is their last conference before government. But are their divisions over Europe surfacing once more?
Cameron's got a lot of credit in the bank with Eurosceptics. He's done what no Tory leader has managed to do. He's created a sensible new Eurosceptic group in the European Parliament, and he, in leaving the European People's Party, I think has established his credentials.
And I'm Mike Duran in London. In other news, a scathing attack on the United Nations' handling of Afghanistan's disputed elections.
It's going to be very difficult to see how the process will have any credibility at all.
British libraries lose out on 5 years of digital news.
There's been this huge change in the way our culture talks to itself and within itself, and the British libraries have been unable effectively to document it.
And Waitrose pulls its adverts from a US right-wing talk show. First, a news update and paper review with Bill Overton.
David Cameron's to rule out a referendum on the Lisbon Treaty for Europe if all 27 countries in the Union have ratified it before the next general election. Now that Ireland's voted in favour, Poland and the Czech Republic say they may follow by the end of the year. Instead, The Guardian's been told the Tory leader will try to get back certain powers if his party is elected to government. They include regaining full control over social, employment and justice affairs. In Brussels, European agriculture ministers are holding a crisis meeting to discuss milk. Farmers are holding demonstrations in the city to protest at the slumping price they're paid as compared to what the consumers charged. The farmers have been dumping millions of gallons for several weeks now. In Greece, the Socialist Party has won a convincing victory to get back into power after losing the last two elections. The party's promised to battle the economic crisis with higher taxes and more public spending. The sitting Conservatives have proposed to cut spending to avoid government debt. In Indonesia, on the island of Sumatra, markets have reopened and some children have gone back to school after last week's earthquakes. It's no longer likely anyone will be found alive by rescue workers still digging through collapsed buildings. Three villages swamped by landslides are to be left as mass graves. On a more cheerful note, a new book about Winnie the Pooh arrives in shops today. Written by David Benedictus with full support from the family of the original author, it'll introduce a new character, Lottie the Otter. She's apparently very keen on proper behaviour and etiquette. David Cameron is the main story on the morning's front pages. The Financial Times says he faces a row at his week's party conference over Europe. The Mail agrees, saying he's being urged to speak out on the subject, while our paper's been told he's now retreated from the idea of holding a referendum on the Lisbon Treaty. The Sun and the Telegraph focus on the Tory party plan to try to claw back government money paid to people on incapacity benefit. As the Telegraph puts it, sickness benefit cheats to face new Tory test. It reports hundreds of thousands will have payments cut by almost a third if they fail tough medical tests. Our paper also leads with the published opinion of the UN number two in Afghanistan, who was fired last week. Peter Galbraith says he was sacked because he wanted it made public that one in three votes cast for President Karzai in the election were fraudulent. The Times reports Iran's already acquired the know-how to make a nuclear bomb and may have already tested a detonation system. The Independent believes vital embryo research has been driven out of Britain. It says all research involved in creating animal-human hybrid embryos has been refused funding. And the Times prints a front-page picture of a baby woolly mammoth which was frozen in Siberia 40,000 years ago. It's helping scientists unlock the secrets of the Ice Age. There's more news and sport throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
I'm Michael White in the Manchester Central Conference Arena, used to be a railway station, where later this morning the Tory party will begin to lay out its plans for government. But before the conference has even started, questions remain about the party's unity over that old, deep, visceral dividing line, Britain's relations with Europe.
Votes in favour of the proposal, 1,214,268. Votes against the proposal, 594,606. Majority in favour of the proposal, 619,662. That concludes our proceedings. Thank you.
That was the returning officer, Maurice Coughlan, announcing the result of the second Irish referendum on the Lisbon Treaty, handily timed for last Friday, just ahead of the Tory conference. It was, of course, a result that paves the way for the treaty's full ratification right across the EU27 and, say it quietly here, opens the door to the possibility of a President Tony Blair. Yes, that one. The treaty still has to be ratified in both Poland and the Czech Republic, but with pressure mounting from Brussels, it's likely, I say likely, to pass into law before next year's British election, circumstances that will force David Cameron to clarify what is a distinctly ambiguous position. Outside the conference centre, I caught up with Douglas Carswell, MP for Harwich and Clacton, and an outspoken opponent of Britain's EU membership on current terms. I asked him what and where Ireland's yes vote leaves the Tory party.
I'm very happy with party policy. It's not been ratified. We don't know if and when it will be ratified. As at present, it hasn't been ratified.
What's your working assumption as a student of these fairs? What will the Poles and the Czechs do? Fall into line or stand out?
I don't know. I imagine it's a matter for the Czech Constitutional Court and the Polish president. But, you know, given where we are, I think our policy is about right.
And assuming it... Let's just take it one step at a time. Assuming it is ratified, what should the party do?
I wouldn't make any assumption. What I would say is this. Cameron's got a lot of credit in the bank with Eurosceptics. He's done what no Tory leader has managed to do. He's created a sensible new Eurosceptic group in the European Parliament. He's broken the monopoly of the Federalist elite. And he, in leaving the European People's Party, I think has established his credentials. He has actually done something concrete. So I think he's earned the benefit of the doubt.
And if the constitution isn't ratified, if the Václav Klaus, the Czech president, holds out, he seems to be the best bet from your point of view, then what happens?
Let's wait and see. It's really a matter for the Czechs. I'm not familiar with the details of the Czech Constitutional Court, but
that's an acceptable answer, yes.
Given where we are, I think policy is good.
You're being very disciplined today.
It's great to be here, and there's a real buzz in the air, and it's great to be part of it.
Real buzz means freezing. It was much warmer in Brighton last week.
There are many things you can blame the government for, but I don't think you can really blame them for the weather.
Douglas Carswell, MP, and lurking at the bar of the Midland Hotel, I've found associate editor of The Sun, Trevor Kavanagh, long-time critic of the European Union. If you think the Eurosceptic son's endorsement of David Cameron last week was less than full-throated, then perhaps the lack of a concrete guarantee of that referendum on the Lisbon Treaty is one reason why. What do you think of the Irish vote, Trevor?
It's a tragedy for the Irish, and for Europe, and for Britain. What it does is put the final nail in the coffin unless we have Václav Klaus standing firm long enough for us to have a referendum too.
What's your instinct about what Klaus will do? I get conflicting signals on this.
My understanding is that he will stand firm as long as he isn't impeached or whatever the Czech government might do to him.
Okay. And what happens to David Cameron if he does buckle and sign? How does Mr. Cameron get himself out of this awkward corner?
Well, I think that it's very difficult for David Cameron. If he signs, then we can't have a referendum. And if we don't have a referendum, the pressure on Cameron is going to grow and become very intense, and something will have to give.
Well, Trevor, how's the Sun's decision to swap ships gone down with Tory voters and Tory leadership? Are they even more glad to see you than usual?
Well, I haven't spoken to any of them since I arrived, but I suspect they're quite pleased.
You must be quite pleased too.
Well, I've got certain views which I express every week in the Sun, so you can probably deduce how I feel from those.
Trevor Kavanagh there. Well, we're here in the enormous aircraft hangar of a press centre at the Manchester conference. If we were at the European Union, it would be five times as large and the food would be free. But instead, we've got Tory posters hanging from the ceiling, a bit like a
Soviet rally,
some say. And they say things like, there is such a thing as society and it's not just the same as the state.
And then the word
social
stronger.
Responsibility. That's Allegra Stratton interrupting there. And Allegra and I are going to talk about the prospects for the week. What are we expecting here? here this week, Allegra?
Well, there's sort of two competing schools of thought. We either have don't mess this up Tory party, which is they're ahead in the polls, so they just carry on trying not to be too sensationalist, too different than they've already been, and cruise to victory in 7 months' time, or they have to start fleshing out some of their other ideas other than the main thrust of what they've been saying over the last few months, which is paying down the fiscal deficit.
There is a funny feeling that at this stage in the proceedings, we ought to know more credible and more detailed Tory policies.
I've just been writing about a policy of how they're going to fund 5,000 extra prison places, taking prison population to over 100,000. And they announced that some months back. And it's parroted in the Daily Mail as a new policy. It's not new.
No, well, all parties are guilty of recycling their policies, but the Tories are in an odd position where they've been promising spending pledges like Billy, a bit like Gordon Brown in a way. Last week he didn't say much about the cuts he was going to have to make, concentrated on the spending pledges. And although David Cameron and George Osborne say they're terribly disciplined, when it actually comes to it, they never sound as if they are. Is that one thing we're going to be watching this weekend, the old cash barometer?
Well, it's also whether, is it a question of they don't want to tell us because the truth is unpalatable? You know, they'll sell off motorways, shock horror. Or is it because they don't know themselves? I don't know.
Well, it's probably a bit of both, in fact. They don't want to frighten the voters. Mm. On the other hand, they're saying to voters, got all this debt, we've got to start paying it down quickly, which is not the view of the G20 finance ministers.
Yeah, indeed. What else to watch out for? I suppose the people to look for are Michael Gove. He's been talking about his Swedish free school policy for ages, and this is the jewel in the crown of their policies.
I think the Swedish finance minister or education minister or somebody said at the weekend, you couldn't make it work in Britain because the Tories aren't giving them enough freedom.
Well, indeed, and this is what somebody said. I don't know, I didn't read that, but this is what somebody had said of a policy that's held up to be their sort of chief bit of new, fresh thinking that excites people like Toby Young so much that he's going to set up a school.
Says he, indeed.
So there's that to watch out for. Who else? Dan Hannan is someone to watch out for. He's the MEP that we all know because he bashed the NHS in America on telly.
The 60-year mistake man. Yeah, I imagine they'll drug him and drop him down a very deep well, weren't they? He's here, though. I've seen him.
He's doing a Wednesday Fringe.
With his mate Douglas Carswell. We've been speaking to him for the programme.
Indeed, so there's that to watch out for. Who else to watch out for?
You haven't mentioned Boris yet, Allegra.
I don't know. I don't like the cult of Boris. I'll leave that to you.
Do you think that the Tory Eurosceptics will be able to contain their fury at the exercise of national sovereignty by the people of Ireland? Or will they push Cameron into a corner where he and Haig clearly don't want to be pushed into promising a referendum, regardless of whether or not this Lisbon Treaty is enforced?
I think it's going to be a fight. I think that
on
to
the
be fair, no,
you
but
said
in the fringes,
best
in the
behaviour.
Well, no, indeed, but in the fringes they can't control it, and the chats in the coffee room they can't control it. Why do I think it's going to be a fight? Because, not unreasonably, if you were so minded to be Eurosceptic, you would think that the High Command's position is a bit untenable. I mean, we just don't know it's very unclear, isn't it?
It certainly is untenable, but they can control themselves on the fringe because it's self-discipline. I'll give you an obvious example. Labour last week did not misbehave in terms of leadership bids on the fringe. It might have done.
But that's different because you've got, a dying animal you don't want to, you know, what did someone say to us? They said, this is like a funeral, no one's rude about the dead at their funeral. And when you've got a party on its knees, you don't go around misbehaving weirdly, even though you probably should. Whereas this is, you know, fairly triumphalist and, we won't see triumph, but behind the scenes they think it's theirs, don't they?
Allegra Stratton there. A conference doesn't start officially until 10 o'clock this morning, when the delegates can expect a rousing speech from the party's rotund chairman, Eric Pickles, a genuine Bradford boy. Later, they'll get Boris Johnson. But away from the main hall, there's a completely different conference to be found, one of pressure groups and think tanks, lobbyists and, yes, retailers. They're all represented under the arched roof of the exhibition hall. Now, I've been coming to political conferences for over 30 years, and I'm standing here in the conference centre. It's called Manchester Central, and it's called that because it used to be Manchester Central, a railway station, and I'm inside an enormous and magnificent railway shed, a bit like Paddington for southerners. Mancunians and people in the north will know it very well. But the surprising thing about it is that I am looking at a a mini shopping mall being erected here for the Conservative Party conference. On my right here is Harvey Nichols, the posh department store, which appears to have bought a lot of booze and goodies in to sell to the Tory delegates. Then I move a little later, there's Crombie, the expensive coat people, then Tesco, the not-so-expensive supermarket. The noises in the background are people who are erecting it all. Carpet right. I wonder if that's anything to do with Lord Harris. He was a carpet man, top Tory donor. Blackwell's, the bookshop is here. Ron Payne's, Silk's Ties, next to Primrose Telecoms and Guy Wakeling Jewelry. Never seen anything like this at a party conference before. Excuse me, madam, can I stop and ask you, what do you hope to sell here? This is the lady who's in charge of the Tesco store.
We're tasting, but our goods are the Sheldon's. It's a very famous local brand. And we hope to be tasting tea cakes, Nevin Bottoms and Balm cakes.
So what do Sheldon's normally do? I don't know them because I'm a soft southerner.
It's a local bakery. They've been here for a long, long time.
What's an oven bottom muffin then?
Right, an oven bottom muffin is turned twice. It's kind of a balm cake that's baked twice on either side, so it's turned.
And what
so
do you eat it with?
It's quite flat. You can eat it with absolutely anything. You can have a savoury sandwich, you can have a sweet sandwich, you can toast it, you can do a pizza with it. But we also sell other things as well.
Right, thank you, ma'am. That's curries. Somebody's selling curries. Oh, and then we're back in familiar territory now. The people who were at the conferences last week, the National Association of Head Teachers, the National Union of Teachers, the Kennel Club, the de Havilland Defence Company, the Countryside Alliance, the Centre for Social Justice. This is what's normally at conferences, but as I say, tacked on at the end is a bit of a retail mini-market. Quite extraordinary.
Guardian Assistant Editor Michael White at the Tory conference in Manchester. In other news, one in three votes in the recent Afghanistan elections was fraudulent, according to Peter Galbraith, the former deputy head of the UN mission there. He was sacked last week after falling out with his now former boss, Kai ID. Galbraith argues the election was a foreseeable train wreck and that the United Nations needs to acknowledge the fraud or risk losing credibility with the many Afghans who don't support President Hamid Karzai. John Boone is in Kabul. He's been following the story for The Guardian.
Well, no, he's made an extraordinary allegation, really. He's come out that this man, who was until very recently, until last week, the second most important diplomat of the UN mission in Afghanistan, has come out and said that 30% of the votes cast for President Karzai in Afghanistan's elections back in August were fraudulent. That's very significant, because if that 30% was removed from the preliminary results, which currently puts President Karzai on almost 55%, then he would not get the half or 50% tally of the votes needed to avoid a second round runoff. So if what Mr. Galbraith is saying, there will have to be a second round vote, although we're still in the process of discovering whether the official audit of a small sample of the ballot boxes from the election, whether that will reveal the level of fraud and will remove enough ballot boxes to force a second round runoff.
Is that likely to happen? I mean, Karzai's main opposition, Abdullah Abdullah, has made it clear he believes fraud took place on a massive scale, but are we stuck with Karzai?
It's going to be very difficult to see how the process will have any credibility at all, particularly in the eyes of many Afghans and many people in the West, particularly Western publics who are growing increasingly wary of the international intervention in Afghanistan. It'll be very hard to see how those people will think that this is anything other than a whitewash. And that, incidentally, is the other thing that Mr. Galbraith has been talking about, essentially alleging that his boss, his former boss, Kai Eide, the Norwegian diplomat who is the UN Secretary General's special representative in Kabul, has essentially been involved in a cover-up to conceal the level of fraud, allegedly suppressing evidence collected by UN field officers, which show that apparently that the turnout in the southern provinces, where violence is greatest, where the Taliban intimidation campaign was at its most effective, UN evidence apparently suggests that very few people turned out to vote, and yet those ballot boxes were stuffed full of votes. Mr. Galbraith says that Mr. Eide has essentially been supporting Mr. Karzai and doing whatever he could to
to ensure that there weren't too many difficult questions asked about fraud. And that, quite apart from the issue about the election, has, I think, also shredded the credibility of the UN mission here and certainly the role of Mr. Ryder. And it's going to be very interesting to see how the mission and how the special representative bounces back from this.
And all this is causing problems for President Obama, isn't it? His commander in Afghanistan, General Stanley McChrystal, is calling for up to 30, 40,000 more troops. So Obama has to convince opposition that the US isn't propping up a corrupt government.
Indeed. And what they need at the end of this process and what has always been at the center of Mr. Obama's strategy is an election that produces a legitimate president, a president who has credibility in the eyes of his own people and also of the of Western public opinion, who ultimately have to pay for this war. Now, if Mr. Karzai gets in, is re-elected without a second round vote, then many people will say, well, hang on a minute, this is not the legitimate president, and how can we possibly spend money and people's lives propping up the government of someone who, you know, I'm sure it will be said, stole the election, or at least benefited from enthusiastic supporters engaging in very, very wide-scale electoral fraud.
John Boone in Kabul. Elsewhere on the Guardian website today, the latest on the Indonesian landslides from our reporter in Western Sumatra. That's at guardian.co.uk/world. A UK drug report shows cocaine use is growing. guardian.co.uk/UK. And the first brand new Winnie the Pooh book in decades goes on sale. Details at guardian.co.uk/books. Still to come, Waitrose pulls out of advertising during a US right-wing talk show.
But I think a lot of people will be very pleased that a British company's taken a stand, not only against, you know, what could be seen as the outrageous views of Beck when it comes to Obama and race, but also the bashing that the National Health Service has taken.
Before that, the British Library has lost more than 5 years of digital literature, online scientific research and internet journalism because of procrastination by ministers. They've failed to give the library legal power to copy and archive websites. This means there'll be a huge gap in Britain's history for online researchers. There'll be no online record of Scottish devolution, the London bombings, the MP's expenses scandal and the release of the Lockerbie bomber, to name just four stories. Our Scotland correspondent Severin Carell explains.
There was an act introduced in 2003 with all-party support called the Legal Deposit Libraries Act, and this bill recognised the fact that the internet and digital publication was becoming a huge and very, very significant part of British political, cultural, scientific and literary life. So what it tried to do was give the British Library and five other libraries in the UK and Ireland the same powers to collect digitally published material as it has for collecting conventionally printed material, which basically meant that if a newspaper like The Guardian or the BBC or even somebody who had a blog was blogging about a subject, the British Library and other libraries across the British Isles could actually collect and archive that without having to ask their permission, and in a way would be able to then preserve and collect Britain's heritage, Britain's history, Britain's culture, Britain's science, Britain's literature for researchers and academics. Now, the problem is that the bill itself, or the act that came into force in 2003, needed some work doing to kind of find and finesse the detail, finesse the manner in which this digital information would be archived. But it's taken more than 6 years to even get to the starting block of beginning a consultation with the general public and with the publishing industry, if you like, on what to do. You know, it seems that DCMS has got no confidence that it'll be able to introduce this legislation before the next election, which means that it will take at least 7 or 8 years for this particular power to be introduced. There's been this huge change in the way our culture talks to itself and within itself, and the British Library's been unable effectively to document it at all effectively.
I mean, is this so important? Because there still is an archive of newspapers, of books and journals, isn't there?
Well, yes, there is. I mean, the point that the British Library and the National Library of Scotland make about this is that in some respects, it isn't an entirely critical loss of knowledge, because most scientific journals are published in printed form, most newspapers are printed in published form. But the difference, the difficulty that they have is that the nature of digital publication, if you like. The nature of the digital discourse is such that there are so many other things which are happening. We're at the birth of this. I mean, we have one comment here from Martin Wade, who is the chief librarian, if you like, for the National Library of Scotland. And he said, "We're missing the birth of a new way of publishing. We've lost 6 years of Scottish digital history. And we continue to lose that history with every month that we don't have this legislation in place." I mean, in the Scottish context, one thing that's being missed, for instance, is with the Scottish National Party taking power in Edinburgh, there's been a huge upsurge in blogging and political discourse on the internet. They liken it to 17th or 18th century pamphleteering. But the National Library of Scotland has been unable to record any of this. And so when historians in 5 years, 50 years or 100 years, try to look back at this extraordinary upsurge in Scottish nationalism, a big chunk of this original history will be missing.
And Britain, we were told, weren't we, that Britain was going to be at the forefront of the digital revolution. This has got to be embarrassing for the government.
Well, exactly. And the funny thing is that the Department of Culture is basically just shrugging and saying, yep, it's tedious, it's taken longer than we expected, but we'll eventually get there.
Severin Correll. Finally, the supermarket where the well-to-do shop for their groceries, I refer to Waitrose, has pulled its advertising from within an American right-wing talk show. Supermarket received complaints that it aired an ad during the Glenn Beck show on Fox News. Beck is a political conservative known for his outspoken views. He publicly accused President Obama of being a deep-seated racist. Sam Jones has the story. He can tell us a little more about Mr. Beck.
Glenn Beck is quite a character, to put it mildly. He presents the Glenn Beck programme on Fox News. He's a man who's known for his outspoken views. He's extremely right-wing, even for somebody on the American right. And he's taken a number of pot shots at various people recently. In July, of course, he decided to, in the wake of the arrest of Henry Louis Gates, the distinguished US academic who was arrested trying to enter his own home, he described President Obama as a racist with a deep-seated hatred for white people or the white culture after the US president waded in and said perhaps police hadn't acted as responsibly or sensitively as they could have. He's also been quite critical of the NHS and some of President Obama's healthcare reforms.
Is he a popular man in America?
He is, actually. He's a very popular man. His ratings for his show are very high, and I believe his audience has gone up something like 10 or 11% since Obama came into office. And in America, where there's less of a division between fact and editorialising, he's an immensely popular man, and he's must-watch material for many, many Americans.
So why has Waitrose pulled out its advertising then?
Well, it seems a number of Waitrose customers, we're not sure quite how many because Waitrose won't tell us, have got rather fed up with Mr. Beck's views, whether on Obama or Fox News generally and its approach to the NHS, which it's bashed a little bit, it's fair to say. They've emailed the chain, which is part of the John Lewis partnership, and said, why are you putting your advertising money into a programme like this? One email I've seen from one Waitrose customer described Glenn Beck as a particular form of right-wing cant and wasn't at all pleased that his preferred shop was flinging cash in that direction. So Waitrose has respected what people have been telling it and has withdrawn its advertising from the Fox News channel in response.
Could this have any repercussions on Waitrose, do you think?
I don't think so. It's the latest in a long line of big companies who've decided to review their advertising as Beck becomes more controversial and more popular, I suppose, as well. But I think a lot of people will be very pleased that a British company's taken a stand, not only against, you know, what could be seen as the outrageous views of Beck when it comes to Obama and race, but also the bashing that the National Health Service has taken.
So there are other companies boycotting the show?
Yeah, Waitrose is actually latest in a long line of companies that have reviewed their positions on advertising since the Obama race storm broke out in July. Some of the biggest names in American business, the likes of Walmart, Travelocity, Radio Shack, CVS, have all pulled their advertising from the Glenn Beck show in the wake of that storm.
And Fox, they're going to keep him?
I think he's a jewel in their crown.
The Guardian's Sam Jones. That's it for today's Guardian Daily. Producing today, Phil Maynard with Michael White in Manchester, Harriet Grant and Tim Mabey in London. I'm Mike Duran. Thanks for listening.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.